a couple of years ago for the arms market. Now, during the last 6 or 7 years that the BJP regime, the Bharatiya Janata Party regime, has been in power, India's economy has declined drastically. These clashes are really, at the moment, a deflection by Mr. Modi, because India's economy is in dire straits.
Mr. Kothari, you earlier said that the reason why all of this is happening is because the Indian economy is in dire straits. So what is the ultimate solution for Kashmir?
And the ultimate solution, the most democratic solution, is self-determination. Okay, respecting the wishes of the people. Now, if the powers that be wanted that to happen, it could happen within 48 hours. If there is a will, there is a way. India and Pakistan are nuclear nations. The road to peace in South Asia, in fact, the road to a just solution of the Kashmir dispute and a just peace in Afghanistan is through Kashmir. Either you build a bridge holding hands with the Kashmiri people, or you build a bridge over the Kashmiri people. But for God's sake, build something. Don't destroy the societies. Don't destroy people. Don't destroy their hopes, just as India has done over the past over 1 year when it abolished Kashmir's limited autonomy. And people live by symbols. We had our own flag. That was taken away from us. We were reduced from a state of the Indian Union to a union territory. And now what has set in over the last 1 year in a very hurried way is what you would call the Israeli model. What Israel has been doing in Palestine, India is now in a very accelerated way doing in Kashmir. Apple trees are being chopped away just as olive trees have been chopped away. Children are being arrested. People are being put in jails for no apparent reason, especially given the COVID situation. Laws are being changed. Demographics are being changed. So we are back to what has happened to Palestine is now, of course, being copied by India. But again, I just want to assure your viewers, and I want to assure myself, that, you know, Modi's come and Modi's go, and inshallah, we will one day learn to how to deal with all this situation. Because, we will get what is due to us and India will get its karma.
All right. The ultimate solution is self-determination. Thank you so much, Mr. Kothari, for being with us and sharing your opinions. It was nice having you with us. Let's see how people on social media see this situation.
By posting painting drawn by a Kashmiri student, Adhar Parvaiz tries to portray the sorrow of the people of Kashmir. Jai Kamath believes that removal of the Article 370 by BJP was just a tool to further oppress the Kashmiris, while most parts of India don't care about them. In this tweet, Safina Nabi shares her observations of the situation of South Kashmir and criticizes the government for its actions in the region. This one is a short video which has recently gone viral, showing how the military forces treat a journalist from India today.
Sir,
referring to the previous post, Tusif Wani expressed concern about the situation of local journalists and how the military forces treat them. And Tony Ashoi also opines that the resistance of the people against oppression will eventually lead to the negotiation of the oppressors with the oppressed.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the Indian-Pakistan border clashes along the line of control in Kashmir. We'll meet next week.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Capitol has mobilized the National Guard ahead of planned protests by Donald Trump's supporters in the lead-up to the congressional vote affirming Joe Biden's election victory. Donald Trump's supporters are planning to rally on Tuesday and Wednesday, 5th and 6th of January, seeking to bolster the president's unproven claims of widespread voter fraud. Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser has requested hundreds of National Guard members to help marshal protests expected around Joe Biden's inauguration. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at The Guardian, with contribution from the Associated Press. The piece is titled, "Trump Protesters Warned Not to Carry Guns as Washington, D.C. Calls Up National Guard." Stay with us for more. The U.S. Capitol has mobilized the National Guard ahead of planned protests by Donald Trump's supporters in the lead-up to the congressional vote affirming Joe Biden's election victory. Donald Trump's supporters are planning to rally on Tuesday and Wednesday, 5th and 6th of January, seeking to bolster the president's unproven claims of widespread voter fraud. Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser has requested hundreds of National Guard members to help marshal protests expected around Joe Biden's inauguration. Washington, D.C. police have posted signs throughout downtown warning that carrying any sort of firearm is illegal, and its acting police chief, Robert Conti, asked residents to warn authorities of anyone who might be armed. "There are people intent on coming to our city armed," Robert Conti said on Monday. It comes as Enrique Tarrio, leader of the violent far-right group the Proud Boys, was arrested in Washington, D.C. and charged with destruction of property related to a previous pro-Trump protest and a firearms offense. President Donald Trump has repeatedly encouraged this week's protest and hinted that he himself may get personally involved. Over the weekend, he retweeted a promotion for the rally with the message, "I will be there, historic day." The rallies are planned to coincide with the official congressional vote on Wednesday, 6th of January, to certify the Electoral College votes from the November presidential election and declare Joe Biden as the winner. A newly elected congresswoman raised the issue of firearms in the Capitol on Sunday, pledging to carry her handgun in Congress. Republican Lauren Boebert from the town of Rifle, Colorado, was reminded by Robert Conti that she would be subjected to the same penalties as anyone else that's caught on the Washington, D.C. streets carrying a firearm. As downtown Washington, D.C. businesses boarded up their windows, Mayor Muriel Bowser requested a limited National Guard deployment to help bolster the Metropolitan Police Department. During a press conference on Monday, 4th of January, Muriel Bowser asked that local residents stay away from downtown D.C. and avoid confrontations with anyone who is looking for a fight. But she warned, "We will not allow people to incite violence, intimidate our residents, or cause destruction in our city." According to a U.S. defense official, Muriel Bowser put in a request on New Year's Eve to have National Guard members on the streets from Tuesday to Thursday to help with the protests. The official said the additional forces will be used for traffic control and other assistance, but they will not be armed or wearing body armor. Some 340 DC National Guard members will be activated, with about 115 on duty in the streets at any given time, said the Defense Department official, who provided details on condition of anonymity to discuss internal deliberations. The official said National Guard members will be used to set up traffic control points around the city and to stand with district police officers at all of the city's metro shops. Robert Conti said Guard troops will also be used for some crowd management. Conti added, some of our intelligence certainly suggests there will be increased crowd sizes. Because Washington, D.C. does not have a governor, the designated commander of the city's National Guard is Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy. Any Washington, D.C. requests for National Guard deployments have to be approved by him. The defense official said that there will be no active duty military troops in the city and the military will not provide any aircraft or intelligence. The Washington, D.C. Guard will provide specialized teams that will be prepared to respond to any chemical or biological incident. But the official said there will be no D.C. Guard members on the National Mall or at the Capitol. At previous pro-Donald Trump rallies and protests, police have sealed off Black Lives Matter Plaza itself, but the confrontations merely spilled out to the surrounding streets. Robert Conti said on Monday, sealing the area again was a very real possibility, but said that decision would depend on the circumstances. We know that historically, over the last few demonstrations, that Black Lives Matter Plaza has been a focal point, Conti said. We want to make sure that that is not an issue. The National Park Service has received three separate applications for pro-Donald Trump protests on Tuesday and Wednesday, 5th and 6th of January, with estimated maximum attendance at around 15,000 people, according to spokesman Mike Litterst. On Monday, a stage was being assembled for one of the protests on the Ellipse, just south of the White House. Organizers plan to rally on Tuesday evening and again all day on Wednesday, 6th of January, including a 1 p.m. march to the Capitol. Expected attendees include high-level Trump supporters such as Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton and Republican strategist Roger Stone, a longtime Donald Trump devotee whose three-year prison sentence was commuted by the president. Roger Stone was convicted of repeatedly lying to Congress during the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. During pro-Trump protests on 12th of December, at least two local black churches had Black Lives Matter banners torn down and set ablaze. Robert Conti said the hate crime investigation into those incidents was ongoing and that his officers would be out in force around churches to prevent similar incidents from happening.
respond.
January the 3rd marked the first anniversary since the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and deputy head of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike. The strike, which also killed a number of their companions near Baghdad International Airport, was carried out under the authorization of U.S. President Donald Trump. Both commanders were deeply revered and respected in the region, particularly due to their efforts to fight terrorism and their key roles in eliminating Daesh from Iraq and Syria. Events were held in Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere in the region to commemorate and pay tributes to the two anti-terror commanders and demand their revenge.
We've seen even a tweet, a message being sent out by the ex-president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, sending his condolences to the people of Iran and the people, the free peoples of the world. And calling Soleimani a hero of the anti-imperialist struggle. This is the reason that people come out in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine, commemorating the martyrdom of these great men.
In statements made on the occasion of first anniversary of the assassination, Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movements asserted that the resistance front will continue down the same path set by General Qasem Soleimani. People in Iraq also held nationwide rallies as well as a ceremony at Baghdad Airport to pay homage to the slain commanders. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of Iran and Iraq's top anti-terrorism commanders in Baghdad. Following the attacks, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of Pentagon's Central Command said last year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The top commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
The U.S. who is staying occupying Iraq because it needs to make sure the resources of this abundant land are not going to the liberation of Arab and Muslim peoples from the yoke of colonization and imperialism. And it's also there to make sure there is no natural continuity between the peoples of the region that have been together for thousands of years, the Iranian peoples and the Arab peoples that have coexisted and coagulated their cultures for centuries. So that is what's happening, and the United States will not leave if it doesn't face resistance to its occupation.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever.
Tensions between Iran and the United States have mounted in recent days ahead of the assassination anniversary of the Iranian top general Qasem Soleimani. But the two sides were at loggerheads for quite some time. In December, the U.S. President Donald Trump accused Iran of playing a role in a series of rocket attacks that targeted the U.S. embassy in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, threatening retaliation. During his 4 years in office, Trump has time and again signaled intentions to launch an attack on Iran. Just last November, after being heavily defeated in the presidential election, Trump was reportedly asking senior advisors about potential options for attacking Iran's main nuclear site. A range of senior advisors dissuaded the outgoing president from moving ahead with a military strike. They warned that a strike against Iran's facilities could easily escalate into a broader conflict in the last weeks of Trump's presidency. Analysts say that Trump could trigger conflict with Iran to distract from his failing attempts to overturn his election loss and to complicate his successor's plans for the region. They say the U.S. president could be thinking about saddling President-elect Biden with some kind of military operation on his way out the door. Even Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has said that Trump is creating a pretext for war. All this is playing out as Biden prepares to enact his own policies after his January 20 inauguration. Biden, on many occasions, has said that he wants to ease Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran and return to the Iran nuclear deal. These are all the steps that hawks in the Trump administration vehemently oppose. Over the past couple of weeks, the U.S. military has beefed up its presence in the region. In mid-December, a U.S. Navy-guided missile submarine made an unusual transit of the Strait of Hormuz, the strategic waterway between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula. Earlier in December, a pair of B-52 bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana flew what the military called a presence mission over the Persian Gulf. That flight was repeated a week later, with two B-52s flying nonstop from North Dakota and heading home after cruising over the western side of the Persian Gulf. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, noted that the U.S. increased military presence in West Asia stems from Washington's fear of the consequences of its past acts of mischief in this region. The IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami, also vowed harsh retaliation against any aggression targeting the country.
We will respond to any move by the enemy with a harder and reciprocally more resolute blow. This has been proven time and time again. We say the same thing today. We will not spare the enemy and will not leave it alone.
Last week, Iran issued a stern warning to the UN Security Council about the U.S.'s recent provocative moves in the region. In a letter to the Council, Iran's permanent mission to the UN raised the alarm over what it called U.S. warmongering tendencies, adding that Washington must bear the full responsibility of the consequences. The letter also echoed Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif's remarks, who said that Iran does not seek war, but will openly and directly defend its people, security, and vital interests.
On the morning of January the 3rd, 2020, the world woke up to the news that top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani had been martyred in Baghdad by a U.S. drone strike, killing General Soleimani and his entourage. The assassination came as Lieutenant General Soleimani had arrived in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government as part of his ongoing mission to fight terrorism in the region, terrorism that saw the Daesh group firmly in the sights of the Iranian military hero. The killing of General Soleimani was unlawful, as UN rapporteur Agnes Callamard clearly pointed out in her report following the assassination, suggesting a legal case against the perpetrators was the way forward. With the ultimate decision to perform the strike on the convoy of General Soleimani lying solely at the feet of the US president, it seems that Iran has a clear case against Trump for the charge of a war crime, as there was no justification for the killing, as confirmed in the UN report. However, the fact that the assassination took place and very little has been done on an international scale to condemn the murder, it appears to have given a green light to other nations to take illegal actions against Iran, in particular the recent example of the killing of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, with officials stating that there had been strong indications that the Israeli regime had been involved in the attack.
Yes, certainly there has to be accountability for this violent and illegal assassination of General Soleimani. The United States, of course, has always felt it is above the law. It doesn't have to maintain any kind of respect for international law or human rights. And that is one of the reasons that the Donald Trump administration proceeded with this assassination. However, this sends the wrong message to the world community. If the United States can get away with it, then anyone can get away with it. So this must be pursued in the international courts. It's interesting to see that Iran is doing just that.
Yet as the anniversary approaches and ultimately passes, Iran has clearly stated that it will pursue its legal duty to fight for justice for the assassination of General Soleimani. And the memory of the talented and much respected general will live on forever in the hearts of those seeking to continue his mission of making the region a safer place to live. The humiliating defeat for Donald Trump that saw Joe Biden sweep to a landslide victory is a sign of just how poor the decisions made have been perceived by the people of the US. Yet as the commander-in-chief of the US military, his decision to call the strike on General Soleimani was a decision that severely dented his international reputation. But as his last few days in office approach, US boats in the Persian Gulf have started maneuvers in the region, suggesting that Trump is looking for one last act of power prior to his departure, believing that until now, he's gotten away with his heinous acts. But for Iran, the most wicked act of all has yet to be dealt with. The assassination of General Soleimani has yet to see Iran take revenge for the murder, and is something that Iran has stated cannot be rushed and will happen in a matter of time.
I think we can say that currently Iran is taking action against the United States by pursuing this assassination in the courts. Someone must be held responsible and accountable for the assassination. Iran is going through the proper channels to do so. That is certainly one method that Iran can take to rectify this situation. The United States, on the other hand, if it's going to invade Iran, it's going to happen in the next 19 days, which is the last of Donald Trump's administration. While I don't expect things will improve greatly under a Biden administration, they will certainly improve somewhat, probably to the reinstatement of the JCPOA.
But for Lieutenant General Soleimani, the hero of people from across the region and the rest of the world, his ongoing work is being continued by devoted followers and freedom fighters from Iraq to Syria and Palestine to Yemen, and this continuation will be one of the best forms of revenge. Furthermore, with General Soleimani being a champion of fighting terrorism in the region, as well as resisting the US presence in the area, it seems that the sweetest revenge of all has been the victory over the US-backed Daesh group and the American assets in the region leaving the area, providing a safe, free, and healthy living environment for the people of the region. The Israeli regime has always prided itself on being the home of the latest cyber technology, boasting about its capabilities in both aggressive and defensive cyber warfare. However, it seems that the regime has counted its eggs a little too early, as a sophisticated hack has shown the real side of Israeli cybersecurity. The hack, which appears to have taken place over a period of months, appears to be from a source known as Pay2Key, with the hackers deploying a form of highly sophisticated ransomware designed to extract high quantities of information from its target, as well as demanding £100,000 in Bitcoin to stop leaks going public. It seems that the hack targeted a cybersecurity company by the name of Portnox, which itself appears to be a major provider of cybersecurity to multiple Israeli regime offices, including the Israeli aerospace industry, El Al, Bezaq, and Clalit Healthcare, many of which have direct links to the Israeli regime and defense systems. Evidence also suggests that much of the information which is threatening to be leaked contains secret information about various Israeli defense networks and companies, which, although not apparent to what exact details are involved, could see highly classified and sensitive Israeli secrets flooded into the public domain. A spokesman for another Israeli cybersecurity company, Clear Sky, announced that the damage done by the hackers has caused significant damage to the Israeli regime and has pointed the finger of blame at Iran as the origin of the attack, raising the question as to just what right does Israel have to put the onus on Iran after the acts the Israeli regime has committed on the country, including, of course, the famous Stuxnet bug, which targeted Iran's peaceful civilian nuclear program.
Even if Iranians were responsible for this latest cyber attack, and indeed the Israeli press has not ascertained culpability yet, and so it said clearly that it can't determine whether or not Iranians were involved, but even if Iranians were involved in this latest cyber attack, Israel would be in no position to complain about it, having taken the cyber gloves off, if you will, by initiating cyber war directly against Iran in 2009 and 10 with the Stuxnet sabotage cyber campaign. This was a campaign of the United States and Israel under the code name Operation Olympic Games, which was designed to destroy elements of Iran's civilian nuclear energy program.
The finger of blame has been pointed at Iran yet again, this time by the Israeli regime. Yet just earlier this month, the US also pointed towards Iran for a series of hacks that were alleged to have breached US voting procedures and officials, something that Iran denied as nonsense. But it seems that Israel is no stranger to cyber attacks themselves, with others predating the Pay 2Key attack. Earlier this year, more than 1,000 Israeli websites were hacked, with images of Tel Aviv in flames, warning Israel that the countdown to destruction had begun, with the Israeli building up a host of enemies due to its hostile actions around the world, from the displacement of people in Palestine to the participation of acts of state-sponsored terrorism. Is it any wonder that Tel Aviv is on the radar of multiple hackers from unknown locations? With such attacks proving that the Israeli regime is both ill-equipped to deal with attacks and too hasty in claiming to be a world leader in security-related issues, has the regime then lost its place at the top of the charts when it comes to cyber and electronic technology?
I believe that this latest hack demonstrates that truly all systems are vulnerable to potential cyber attack. And considering the fact that Israel prides itself so much on its high technology and its cybersecurity, this just proves that even the Israeli cybersecurity can be broken. And so this raises the question, why play with fire, especially when fire will be fought with fire?
There's no doubt that the hack is, and may further yet to prove, a huge embarrassment for the Israeli regime, in particular as the details of the information obtained is yet to be revealed by the hackers, and is similar in nature to a recent hack on US bodies, which the US alleged originated from Russia. Yet with allegations flying around, the priority now for the Israeli regime is to hope that the information obtained does not fall into the public domain, and further shame the regime that appears to have no shame.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The Limelight.
The pardoning of four Blackwater mercenaries by U.S. President Donald Trump was an action that violated international law, a group of experts at the United Nations said recently. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, UN Experts Say Trump violated international law in pardoning Blackwater mercenaries. Here's the details of this article. The pardoning of four Blackwater mercenaries by U.S. President Donald Trump was an action that violated international law, a group of experts at the United Nations said recently. Trump pardoned the four contractors, including Nicholas Sladen, who was convicted of first-degree murder, as well as Paul Slough, Yvonne Liberty, and Dustin Hurd, all three who were convicted of voluntary and attempt manslaughter, as part of more than a dozen pardons and commutations. Those contractors were convicted for opening fire on a crowd and killing a number of individuals in 2007 in what has become known as the Nisour Square Massacre in Baghdad, Iraq. 17 unarmed Iraqi citizens were killed in total. The youngest victim in that shooting, Ali Kenani, was just 9 years old when he was killed by the four Blackwater contractors. His father, Muhammad Kenani, recounted the scene he witnessed when the massacre happened. Muhammad Kenani said, "When one man tried to run, they shot him," Kenani said in a Democracy Now! Interview from 2010. He dropped dead on the spot. He was on the ground, bleeding, and they were shooting nonstop. They shot like they were trying to kill everyone they could. Due to how vicious and criminal these men's actions were, members of the UN condemned Trump's decision to pardon them, describing his actions as criminal while doing so. Pardoning the Blackwater contractors is an affront to justice and to the victims of the Nisour Square massacre and their families. Jelena Aparak, chair of a UN working group on the use of mercenaries, said recently of Trump's pardoning of the four Blackwater contractors. "The President of the United States has tremendous leeway when it comes to whom they may pardon." Many scholars believe there are still limits to the pardon power, particularly when it comes to consideration for other laws, including international agreements and treaties, which are treated as the supreme law of the land according to the U.S. Constitution. In that respect, it's possible that Trump violated the Geneva Conventions when he pardoned these four individuals, as member states to that agreement are responsible for holding war criminals in their own country accountable for their actions.
private contractors or mercenaries are included in those Geneva Conventions agreements. There are grave consequences, according to those agreements, for not adhering to this rule, ignoring or curtailing punishments for war criminals. We luckily encourage other nations, for instance, to hire private contractors in order to break the spirit of the international agreement. With that in mind, the pardons are in violation of U.S. obligations under international law and will undermine humanitarian law and human rights at a global level, APRAC, the UN expert, said. Ensuring accountability for such crimes is fundamental to humanity and to the community of nations, APRAC elaborated, adding that pardons, amnesties, or any other forms of exculpation for war crimes open doors to future abuses when states contract private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Marjorie Kahn, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and Deputy Secretary General of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, expressed similar sentiments. Kahn, speaking directly to the reporters about the matter, also said that Trump should have pardoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange for his role in revealing other atrocities of U.S. military in the years past. The Geneva Conventions require that the states hold war crimes criminals accountable, Kahn said, yet Trump pardoned four war criminals, but indicted Julian Assange for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes and criminals in Iraq. Kahn continued, Assange published the collateral murder video, which depicts U.S. troops killing 18 civilians in violation of the Geneva Conventions. Trump should dismiss the indictment against Assange and grant him a full pardon.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Saeed Bourezza. We'll kick things off here in London, where a court has ruled WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange cannot be extradited to the United States. The judge denied the request for extradition because of concerns over Mr. Assange's mental health and risk of suicide in the U.S. Ahmed Caballo was outside the Old Bailey court.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a U.S. supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the U.S. prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian.
Yes.
Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
Situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US and internationally. Because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, or the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defence's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Kabbalo, London.
Well, and Ahmed Kabbalo joins me live now for more on that story. Ahmed, you covered a lot of ground in your report. Tell us what the mood was outside the court and also your reaction to today's landmark ruling as you joined fellow journalists to cover today's proceedings.
Well, it was a mixture of euphoria and relief for many of Julian's supporters who were outside the court today. People were crying, people in disbelief, and very few expected the result that was announced shortly after 11 a.m. this morning. But many still feel that the way that Julian was treated, the way that his family was treated, the fact that he was denied visitation rights, denied access to his legal papers, and was not even able to follow the proceedings of his own extradition hearing, was a scandal and something that should not happen in a country that calls itself a democracy, in a country that claims to value freedom of expression and freedom of the press. And many feel that the fact that Julian was treated in this way in itself is enough of a deterrent to stop other people for exposing US war crimes and crimes against humanity, particularly as not a single high-ranking US or UK official or politician has ever stepped foot in a courtroom or been held accountable for those war crimes.
And Ahmed, what do you make of the fact that the judge denied the extradition request based on health grounds?
Yeah, I mean, that is potentially the most worrying part of today's ruling. Of course, it's great news for Julian and his family that he's been, the extradition has been blocked. But the judge essentially agreed with the arguments made by the US prosecutors. So the judge did not take into account that what Julian published was overwhelmingly in the public interest, that the case was politically motivated, that it was taken up by Donald Trump and not taken up by Barack Obama's administration. None of the arguments about freedom of press and the right for journalists to hold governments to account, or for the British and American public to know what their military and government's up to, no. She denied the request on mental health grounds, that if Julian Assange was extradited to the United States, where he'd most likely go to a US supermax prison and be placed under special administrative measures, that it would be serious risk to his life, to him committing suicide, and to his mental health. And so that opens the gate for other journalists to be prosecuted who do not have mental health issues, who want to expose war crimes. And it kind of suggests that field of holding governments to account, of holding US and American military account, is still not open for journalists, and that it was only Julian's mental health that stopped him from being extradited to the United States.
All right, Ahmed Kabbalo, thank you. Moving on now, the UK is straining every sinew to keep COVID-19 in check as the new variant of the virus blazes through the population. More cases are being announced daily than during the peak of the last lockdown, The daily death toll has shot up as well, so despite the UK being the first to roll out vaccines, many schools will not be opening. Calls for another lockdown are getting louder, but the government is biding its time. Bianca Rahimi tells us more in this report.
The UK's National Health Service is buckling under the pressure. A lack of beds and staff is taking its toll, with people being treated in ambulances queuing outside hospitals. Public health experts are warning it's going to get worse before it gets better.
If you look at the number of COVID patients in hospital beds in London, that has increased by over 45% over the last 8 days. So we are seeing extreme levels of pressure that the NHS hasn't really experienced for a very long time.
The UK government is very proud of being the first country to roll out COVID-19 vaccines. The Pfizer jab on December 8th and the AstraZeneca vaccine on January 4th. More than 1 million Britons have received their first dose, and the government says its target is to vaccinate tens of millions by April. Nonetheless, Downing Street is being accused of dithering and making poor decisions.
I really, really worry about the NHS being overwhelmed, but more importantly, the virus is just going to get a tighter and tighter grip on communities right across the country. And vaccination is not going to come quick enough to help us in that. And it's going to be very, very bad. And the Prime Minister talks about being rough and rocky. It's going to be disastrous if we don't get this under control.
Schools were set to open January 4th, but citing record high infection rates in some areas, many were told to stay closed after the Christmas holidays, giving teachers only days to prepare for online teaching. The government has stopped short of announcing another lockdown, but the opposition says delaying the inevitable will cost lives.
The virus is clearly out of control, and there's no good the Prime Minister hinting that further restrictions are coming to place in a week or two or three. That delay has been the source of so many problems. So I say bringing those restrictions now, national restrictions, within the next 24 hours. That has to be the first step to controlling the virus.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson says there is no question that tougher restrictions are needed and that they will be announced in due course. This comes after the health secretary admitted the tier system was not strong enough to deal with the new variant, which spreads much faster. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Let's get some thoughts on that story. Lembit Opec is a former MP and political commentator joining me now. It's good to have you with us. So it's been described as chaos and confusion. Not the first time we're hearing that as people return from the Christmas period. Your assessment of what we're witnessing?
Well, those two words are accurate. It's been chaotic because the government has not really given a very clear steer. And as you heard in that report, they delay the decision making, and that leads to the confusion. The public has been very obedient, very cooperative for almost a year now, and they're getting rather fed up. So the real danger here is, even if the government thinks it knows what it's doing, the public don't think the government knows what it's doing. And I've met politicians who live in Tier 4, and they don't even understand those rules. How on earth is anything going to get simpler if they're going to further complicate the system?
Let's dig deeper into the dithering on the part of the government. What it claims to do is it's following the science when it suits them, but then they consistently delay and then perform U-turns. How long can this go on for?
Well, they've performed so many U-turns that it's turned into a circle. And when they say they follow the science, one has to conclude that, in their view, the science keeps changing. Well, the difficulty here is the frustration that it creates, a nervous and an uncomfortable public that's been told repeatedly that this is a lethal weapon and we have to be responsible with it. If the public don't have faith in the government, then the government can't have faith that the public's going to follow that. And what this all adds up to is this kind of delay and really the feeling that the government has lost control, and that lack of confidence in the government is in itself likely to cause people to make their own rules up. And if those rules happen to be less than ideal in terms of this new variant of COVID-19, then the disease will carry on spreading.
One final question very quickly. I'll begin with the latest toll, more than 58,000 new cases, 407 deaths over the past 24 hours, new highs really, higher even than the first lockdown. There's growing talk of a new national lockdown. We heard the Labour Party leader say that in our report as well. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there has to be a new national lockdown. And once again, all the government has done so far is cause us to ask, when will they wake up and smell the coffee? The doctors are saying it. The other parts of the United Kingdom, the nations are saying it. England has to say it too. And every day that goes by that they don't have a national lockdown, except for essential things like work, will be more lives lost.
And of course, national lockdown announced by the Scottish First Minister earlier today as well. Lembit Opec, thank you.
Thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
To other stories now. This one about a Spanish-flagged humanitarian ship seeking a port of safety Sunday for 265 migrants its crew rescued from the Mediterranean Sea in the last few days. Spanish NGO Open Arms Charity tweeted Saturday that 19 of its passengers, mainly from Eritrea, among them two women and 17 minors, were suffering from hypothermia. In a separate tweet, the organization said some 169 of the passengers had been rescued from a flimsy wooden boat left adrift in international waters. Prior to this, Open Arms Charity accused European governments of frequently abandoning refugees and migrants who often embark on perilous journeys through the Mediterranean to reach European shores. Norwegian police have found seven bodies after a massive landslide destroyed homes in the city of Ask near the capital Oslo. Search teams with dogs aided by helicopters and drones with heat-detecting cameras are looking for the missing. Local police say the chances of finding anyone alive are fading. At least 1,000 people were forced to evacuate their homes by the worst landslide to have hit Norway in modern history. 2020 may be remembered as one of the worst years in recent human memory, but especially so for Iraq. The country has been forced to adapt to fight corruption, foreign aggression, and the pandemic. But as Robert Carter finds out, despite all their challenges, the Iraqis are holding together.
Faced with a new deadly virus threat, Iraq's vulnerable citizens have found themselves in a new war for survival, only this time against an invisible enemy. But many in Iraq are not turning towards the state for help, rather seeking aid and guidance from the religious authorities, including the Ataba administrations of the Holy Shia Shrines and Iraq's Grand Ayatollahs, particularly Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani.
As you surely realize from your visit to Ataba, Ayatollah Sistani has improved on his already achieved successes. We now have centers in the religious seminaries which sponsor learning and invest in scientific education. It is he who helps people learn how to become more educated in medicine.
One of the areas which the Ataba has invested heavily in is the medical infrastructure here in Iraq. For example, these hospitals which you see dotted around the major cities in the country have been playing a major role in supporting all types of Iraqi people, including widows of fallen fighters who died fighting against terrorist groups such as Daesh, and also helping families who have been fighting back against the COVID-19 outbreak.
Since the arrival of COVID-19, Iraq's clerical elite have mobilized at breakneck speeds, setting up new hospitals and COVID treatment centers across the country. Karbala's Zain al-Abidin Hospital is a newly built, state-of-the-art medical facility which caters for much of the local community's needs. Much of the funding for these anti-COVID facilities has come from the Ataba organization, which manages the Imam Hussein Grand Masjid. But their support doesn't end here. The Shrine factions have been investing heavily in the education sector too, to train a new generation of professionals in the field of medicine.
The university attracts distinctive students with all type of specialities and without discriminating against gender. The best are working here to teach sciences of many types. We manage the process of learning until the students